CNN anchor and correspondent Jake Tapper is best known for his hard-nosed interviews that seek to get at the truth of our contentious times. But in his new novel, Tapper turns his attention to another fractious period in U.S. history. In The Hellfire Club, a political thriller set in 1950s Washington, Tapper writes about a time when the Red Scare and McCarthyism ruled the city. As for his day job, he hosts The Lead and State of the Union on CNN, and Jake Tapper brings attention to some of the biggest political headlines. He joins us this morning to talk about his inspiration for his foray into fiction, his life as a journalist, his background as a political cartoonist, and which recent news stories have captured his full attention. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jake Tapper to the roundtable. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Joe.
You grew up where outside of Philadelphia?
Well, my parents divorced when I was about 7 or 8. My mom still lives in the same house in Center City, Philadelphia, Queen Village, that we moved to when I was a few months old. My dad now lives in Marion, right outside.
That's where you essentially grew up.
Well, they had joint custody, so my brother and I split our time 50-50. But my high school was in the suburbs.
I wonder, at what point did you ever have a Philly accent, or did you lose it?
Oh, it's funny that you say that, because Philadelphians, I keep hearing all the time about how I still have a Philadelphia accent. About somebody wrote, if you Google Jake Tapper in Hoagie Mouth, a local writer wrote a whole essay about how my Philadelphia accent still rears its head.
I find it fascinating because you and I are almost the identical age, and we grew up in the same part, basically the same part of outside of the city. And so I have the same thing where people from the city will notice that I say certain words.
Like water?
Water.
Yeah, down the shore.
And I think I have lost it until, of course, you go back.
Yeah, maybe when I go back. I mean, it's funny. I never even discerned what a Philadelphia accent was until people from Philly started noticing me on TV and hearing, you know. But to me, it's like when you say, when somebody would say, Hoagie. Hoagie, like that's right. A Philly accent, but I don't hear it in my own voice. I mean, I guess Philadelphia accents are a little bit more nasal, and we take a lot of shortcuts, like water. But I don't discern it. But you know, I guess people in France don't think they have accents either.
When you went into broadcast journalism, that was not the original goal.
My original goal, I mean, it depends on how far back you want to go. At first, I wanted to be a comic strip cartoonist after college. Then I was kind of floundering because that didn't work out. And I was doing, I worked on a political campaign, and then that woman won. And so I was her press secretary. Then I did some PR. And I was kind of spent my 20s like trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Ultimately, I started doing freelance writing and ultimately became a journalist full time by the age of 29. But it was not a direct path, and I did not have a clear goal. Then once I became a journalist, it wasn't as though I thought, hey, someday I'd like to have my own show on CNN. It was more, I like this, and I did that for, you know, so I worked at Washington City Paper. I did that for a year or so. Then Salon came calling, so I became a political journalist for a .com. Then ABC News. I mean, things just kept on happening every few years, but it wasn't like one long-term goal.
Where do you think you developed your moral journalistic compass?
Well, that's a good question. I guess that it's just a moral compass, which is just my parents, I think of as moral people, and they were not partisan by any stretch. I mean, to grow up in the 70s in Philadelphia, everybody was a Democrat. So it was just crooks and non-crooks. Really, there wasn't really, and those were the two parties, and they were all Democrats. So there was just a question of right and wrong. And, you know, I've always been somebody that listens to criticism. And so when I became a journalist and I would hear criticism of journalists when it comes to whether or not we were too this or too that, too liberal, too pro-corporate America, whatever, I would listen to those criticisms. So I don't know. I mean, I just think whatever morality or sense of right and wrong that I had as a person or as a news consumer, in terms of fairness or in terms of accuracy, I just brought to the table as a journalist.
It was about a year ago when I was having a conversation with David McCullough, who I've become friendly with, a great historian, and he said to me that during this time in covering what we're covering, covering politics, that we have to, he as an historian, we as journalists, have to stop looking at right versus left and instead look at right versus wrong.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
And it seems that you are one of the few people that really do that.
Well, first of all, I think the part of doing that is, I don't know that I agree that I'm one of the few people doing it, but part of doing it is I'm not partisan. I'm actually, like, if I were not a journalist, I still would be a registered independent. I don't look at the Democratic Party and I don't look at the Republican Party and think that's the party that has the answers. I try to explicitly not take stances on policy debates. I don't have a position on immigration. I don't have a position on tax bills. I don't have a position on North Korea. I don't have a position on Afghanistan. I believe in asking probing tough questions about those subjects, but I don't have a conclusion about which one is better than the other. But I also think that along with a refusal to take a position on policy issues or partisan debates, it is incumbent upon journalists to take a position on facts, truth, and decency. And I actually think that one helps the other. If you don't have a position on partisan issues and you don't have a position on policy issues, I feel like theoretically, at least, you should be able to have more of a platform to say that this is wrong or this is a lie or this is indecent, to make fun of disabled people or whatever. So that's just kind of how I look at the world. And it has been in the Trump era that I have been kind of forced to crystallize what I think in terms of setting up parameters and rules to explain it. But I think it's pretty much always how I felt.
Forgive the premise of this question if it comes off as overly psychological. However, when I watch you, which is I either listen to or watch you, and what strikes me is that we heard so often about the concern of the normalization of this type of behavior from this president. You always seem surprised. It seems as though you still do not find any of this normal.
It's not normal. It's not. I think when I lose the capacity to be surprised and upset by decency is the time that I should be put out to pasture, probably. I mean, look, let's just take a recent example. Senator John McCain, with whom many people have many disagreements, is dying of brain cancer. Senator John McCain is a war hero who served 5.5 years in a POW camp when he could have been released earlier because he didn't want to be released before other people who should be released before him, who had been there longer. Those are just facts. Somebody at the White House said something that I guess was supposed to be a joke about he's dying anyway, so who cares that he's opposed to the CIA director nominee. It got out in the press. It's horrific to make light of somebody dying of brain cancer. It would be horrific if she had done that about anyone, but she was doing it not only about somebody, but about somebody who had dedicated his life to public service and who had been a war hero in Vietnam. The idea that, you know, days later, we're still discussing that the White House did not apologize for the comment and seems more offended by the leak of the comment than by the content of the comment, that's not normal. That's not anything that we have experienced in the modern era. And I am not going to pretend that it is. It's indecent, and the McCain family deserves our sympathy and our respect.
It seems as though that even if you get we've seen it once or twice in this administration of a begrudging, well, maybe should have said this, but I don't understand, putting on your press secretary hat for a second, what does anyone gain from letting this story become a 7, 8, 9 day story as opposed to which it could have been?
I don't. First of all, I was a horrible press secretary back in 1992, so I can't say that I bring skills to the job. It doesn't make any sense except for the context that President Trump thinks that apologies are weak. Beyond that, there is no sense that it makes, because it doesn't make sense on a level of decency. It doesn't make sense on a level of public relations. But, you know, he does not think apologies are strong. Even when he issued his quote-unquote apology for the Access Hollywood tape, within that apology was an attack on Bill Clinton and a lot of fighting, as opposed to what most of us probably would have done in a similar situation would have been, you know, that's not reflective of who I am. I regret it. I'm really sorry. I'm embarrassed by it. That's not the lesson I want our children to learn, et cetera. So, I mean, that it just has to do with his psychology, not with mine per se. But, you know, I think it's good if you're interviewing me in 5 years and you are not still saying to me, let's assume President Trump is still president in 5 years, or who knows who's going to be president in 5 years, Superfly Snuka. I mean, like, for all I know,
we don't know.
It's going to get worse, you know. But if I am not still shocked by public officials saying things that are inherently indecent, then you should remind me of that and tell me it's time to retire.
With that said, however, is this an exciting time to be a journalist, or is it still incredibly frustrating?
It's great that people are engaged, and it's great that there are a lot of journalists rising to this moment. I see a lot of amazing journalism out there by the Washington Post and the New York Times and CNN and the Wall Street Journal and others. But I don't know one journalist who wouldn't rather, in exchange for fewer readers and fewer viewers, have fewer lies and a return to more, more normal, less indecent period. It is thrilling and challenging on a professional level, but on a personal level, it's not fun to watch the discourse go into the mud. It's not fun to watch, I know the McCains a little bit. I've been covering him for 20 years.
Sure.
And I know that these attacks took a toll on Senator John McCain's family, on his wife, on his daughter. Well, his daughter's on The View, so you can see every day it's taking a toll on her and the fact that it's taking up psychic energy. That's not fun. I mean, I'm glad we have content, but I would rather, when I started my show on CNN in 2013, there were days that my executive producer and I would be talking about how are we going to fill an hour. What are we going to do today to fill an hour? We never have that problem anymore.
No.
We have too much. We can't even get to Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator. You know, there's so much else going on. But I would prefer to go back to 2013 if I really got to choose.
I was thinking about your particular dilemma, perhaps, in that often you come on right after the press briefing.
Yeah.
Is that content? I mean, you have more to work with, or sometimes just because you know it is what it is that you tend to push it aside? And
it depends on what Sarah Sanders or Roz Shah say in the briefing. And look, I mean, I want to make it clear, like, this is not, I'm not talking now about the policy debates surrounding the Trump administration, which I think are worthy. If he succeeds in North Korea, wonderful. You know, if he is encouraging the United States and the Congress and others to think differently about trade deals or how we send our troops to war or, you know, any of these things.
Important discussions.
Yeah, the important discussions, policy debates I'm ready to have that we have on our show, that we air both sides, that or five sides, however many sides there are. Sometimes we have, you know, on a panel you might have a pro-Trump Republican, a never-Trump Republican, an establishment Democrat, a Bernie Democrat. There's so many different gradations today. But that said, I mean, that's different, and I think that's all good. We should be, and it's good to shake up the system. But I'm specifically talking about the lies and indecency, which are, I think, problematic to me as an American, not as a journalist.
Give us a sense of what you're allowed to do, meaning, when I say allow, what time permits you to do of your own journalism throughout the day by the time you get on the air at 4 o'clock.
I mean, sometimes there's a story that I will break. Sometimes that there is a take on a story that I will try to bring context to through clips or through history or through an attempted analysis. We have a lot of great reporters at CNN. We also, obviously, if the New York Times breaks a story, we're going to cover that as well. There's a lot. I mean, it is overwhelming in terms of the content, in terms of what there is to talk about, in terms of President Trump and North Korea, President Trump and the Russia investigation, President Trump and this legislation on Capitol Hill. Being an anchor is different from being a correspondent. When you're a correspondent, or when I was, You're trying to break stories a lot more than when you're an anchor. You're trying to like figure out how to put the show together and how to provide analysis and context. So I don't have as much time as an anchor as I did as a correspondent to break stories or you know, get new information.
When you walk into an interview for the Sunday show and you're going to interview John Bolton, mm-hmm. what are your expectations going in? I mean, what do you expect to get out of that as far as news and an interesting conversation for the viewer?
For every interview with whoever, whether it's Kellyanne Conway and John Bolton from the White House or Senator Mark Warner from the Democrat from Virginia from the Senate, we discuss what kind of interview we want it to be, what is right for the moment. So, for instance, a Kellyanne Conway interview right around the time that it's been very clear that President Trump is lying about what he knew about the Stormy Daniels payment might be more about me pressing her on President Trump telling so many lies. And that might be the focus of the interview in various ways. For John Bolton, there's no one hard and fast rule, so I can just tell you about the last two interviews I did with White House people. So that you know, Kellyanne Conway came at a time that it was very clear that President Trump had been lying about the Stormy Daniels payment. You know, a story broken by his own attorney, Rudy Giuliani. But when we did John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, that was more of an interview where I wanted to get information about what the White House thinking was. We really only talked about three topics. We talked about, and it was like a 15-minute interview. We did North Korea, the summit, and what was going on, what the expectations were, et cetera. Iran, the Iran deal, which the president had just announced he was going to pull the U.S. out of, and what the repercussions might be, and all the information that didn't add up. I mean, how are you going to press for a better deal if you don't have all Europe and China and Russia joining with you on new sanctions? And then we talked about McCain. So it's really just, I mean, you have to decide whether you want it to be an informational interview or you want it to be more of an adversarial interview. Sometimes one turns into the other and vice versa, but that's how I do it.
All right. So let's talk about Stephen Miller for a second.
Okay.
So
inevitably.
Inevitably, yes. We have to talk about the Stephen Miller interview. You had to take him out of the studio. You cut it short, and you for anyone who hasn't seen it or heard it, you should, because you just become exasperated. Well, you tell me what you became. You it seems like you just were at the end of your rope. That this wasn't you, this you were wasting. You said you're wasting my viewers' time.
I've known Stephen Miller for years. He was a press secretary on Capitol Hill for Jeff Sessions, and before that for other people like Michelle Bachmann. So I've known him for a long time and had, quite honestly, a fine relationship with him. And he'd been on my show before. So I did not see that coming. I did not know that he was coming there to my show, in my opinion, to play to one, an audience of one, to attack me, to attack CNN, and to praise President Trump, which is what he did. He came on the show. They offered him. The way it works is you ask the White House, are you putting anybody out there? What guests can we have? And they give you offers, and you either accept or you reject it. And that's just how it works. And I remember that weekend they were putting out Nikki Haley and Mike Pompeo, and I would have preferred either of them to Stephen Miller, but they offered us Stephen Miller. And it was right after Fire and Fury, the Michael Wolff book, had come out. And it was right after Steve Bannon was being attacked by President Trump. And Steve Bannon was a friend and ally of Steve Miller. So we accepted, thinking, okay, well, maybe we'll get the White House point of view on this book and on Steve Bannon. And, you know, to be honest, like, I hadn't said particularly nice things about the book. I thought Fire and Fury was a very problematic book and had a lot of facts wrong in it, and journalistically was a problem. The quotes he had from Steve Bannon were a huge achievement and big news. But beyond that, I wasn't like I was a booster of the book. So, you know, I asked him the Bannon question, and he took 2 or 3 minutes to basically filibuster about what a horrible person Steve Bannon was, which I knew he would do. And then I wanted to ask him about other things that the president had said, such as, I think that day or the day before, he had called himself a very stable genius. You might remember Michael Wolff had started the debate about whether or not Trump was mentally incapacitated.
Right.
And that's when Miller, in my view, went off the rails and started attacking me personally, started attacking CNN, started saying that the tone in the country was worse because of CNN. And, you know, I pushed back. At the point that he started repeating stories about how amazing Donald Trump was, that he could give a speech and riff on the news of the day during the campaign, the second time he told that story, The first time it was lame enough. The second time he told that story in a 10-minute period. And like he wasn't answering my questions, and it was just just vicious ad hominem attacks. I wasn't, by the way, I mean, anybody watching the interview, I wasn't attacking President Trump. I would say things like, when the president says he's a very stable genius, does that help him make the case or does it undermine his case? Just that, you know, simple question. And yeah, I had to end the interview. And then during the commercial break, he wouldn't leave the studio, and we had to have the security guard escort him out of the studio, not because he was a threat to me, but because he wouldn't leave and we were about to come back from commercial break on live television, and he had to be escorted out down the elevator and out of the building. And then he lied about it on Fox News the next night. It was weird. I mean, you know, knowing then what I know now, I wouldn't have booked him. I thought that we were going to get an informational interview. I thought that he was going to provide the White House point of view. Instead, he was just trying to dance before, you know, King Trump. And I thought it was embarrassing on his behalf.
Has anyone in the network had him on since?
Not only has CNN not had him on, you haven't really seen him on television a lot at all. The White House hasn't put him on. Mm. And I think that speaks to how they really feel about his performance on the show that day, as opposed to the tweet the president sent out in which he attacked me and said how great Stephen Miller had done. If they really thought Stephen Miller had done a great job, we'd be seeing him on cable news every week. I haven't seen him on cable news since that week.
Given that you're doing this every day, and God knows what each day is going to bring us, there was a time where you were looking to fill time, and now it's how do you get it all in? So on top of this, you say, oh, I'll write a novel.
Well, I was working on the novel before. I mean, the idea of the novel occurred to me maybe like a decade ago when I first heard about this actual secret society, the Hellfire Club, in the 1700s in England. And I'd heard that, you know, and I'd read that Ben Franklin had gone to one of these debaucherous orgies. And that's when the light went off. And then I started writing it about 3 or 4 years ago, before Donald Trump was the nominee of the Republican Party presidential nomination. So it was before the time got too insane that I started it. But the truth is that writing it was a great respite. It was a way to turn off the insanity of the day. I don't know how you're doing, but I know that the first year of covering the Trump administration was nuts, both as a journalist and as a news consumer, because every 3 minutes something happened.
Right.
And it still happens that way. I'll be doing a show and news breaks during the show. One time I did a commentary at the top of my show, an analysis, just about how much news had broken in the previous 24 hours. I forget what it was because I can't keep track of these things anymore. But three big stories had broken just in the last 24 hours. And then before the half hour was done in my hour-long show, it was announced that Hope Hicks was leaving the White House. I mean, it just never ends. The news cycle never ends, which I suppose is eminently predictable in a Trump White House, given the fact that he loves to be the center of attention.
When it comes to then of writing about it, is that a respite, if you will? Is that a moment away from that cacophony?
Yeah, it's tuning it out. It's not having to pay attention to Trump or the people who hate Trump or the people who love Trump or Twitter. It is my own little world, this creation in 1954, where I control the politicians. I know how the story ends. I can have good guys win. I can do some light commentary on what I'm witnessing in 2018. Or 2016 and 17, while also really focusing on 1954 and this plot. And it was fun. You know, the last book I wrote was nonfiction. It was called The Outpost, mm-hmm. An Untold Story of American Valor. And it was about this one combat outpost in Afghanistan. It was a real story about the deadliest day for the U.S. in Afghanistan in 2009. And it was gut-wrenching to write. I did more than 200 interviews. I went to Afghanistan twice. I spent a lot of time with a lot of people and a lot of pain. And it was very difficult emotionally to write this book, much more difficult for them, of course, but difficult to tell their stories. This, I knew whatever my next writing project was going to be, it was not going to be that, because that was emotionally taxing. And so I wanted something that might be fun. And this was fun. This was fun to write. And that's what I wanted the experience to be for the reader, too. I wanted it to be fun. You know, maybe a couple moments of insight here and there, but generally I wanted to be a page turner, kind of a fun trip to a world that nobody, very few people alive have been ever experienced.
Fun for you once you get the mental picture of Benjamin Franklin at an orgy out of your mind, right?
That's not fun for you, the idea of Ben Franklin at an orgy?
Are we going to be okay?
You know, I get asked this question a lot, and the truth of the matter is I think we are. And I think we are because of the wisdom of people like Benjamin Franklin and other founding fathers who set up a system of government and a place of freedom where there are checks and balances, where, you know, Mueller, at least as of this moment, Robert Mueller, the special counsel investigating whether or not there was collusion and whether or not there was obstruction and whatever else he's looking into, still has his job and is still investigating. That is remarkable in any country. But he's, you know, he stands there doing his job. We in the media, for all of the president's anti-media rhetoric, and I don't like it at all, and I don't like what he's doing in terms of eroding faith that people have in journalism, we're still doing our jobs. And the media, generally speaking, I think is rising to the moment. So, yes, I think we're going to be okay. I think we're going to be okay. We're going to get through this period, and I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that I have lived in Washington long enough to know that I have now lived, this will be my, I've lived there through the Clinton years, the Bush years, the Obama years, I'm now there in the Trump years. I know that no matter what happens, Washington is still standing and the next president comes in and things change however they change, for the better, for the worse. But the American system endures. You know, if anything, I think that the American people, both pro-Trump and anti-Trump, are engaged more in a civic way than they have been before, and that's good too. So I don't want to be too Pollyannish about this, but I mean, I think that there is good in this, and I think that we have seen our systems function properly. Congress could be a little gutsier. Congress could do a little bit more oversight, but generally speaking, I think we're going to be okay. Yeah.
Jake Tapper is a CNN anchor and correspondent, of course, the host of The Lead in State of the Union. His new novel is The Hellfire Club. It is published by Little Brown. We'll have a complete interview with Jake Tapper regarding the book on our book show Tuesdays afternoon at 3 and Thursday evening at 8:30. Jake Tapper, a great pleasure to have this much time to speak with you. Thank you very much.
This was fun, Joe. Thanks so much.
Great pleasure. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.